All right, and welcome to the holiday edition of American Hit Radio.
Is it?
On WHPC 90.3 FM in Garden City, New York, where we're coming to you. I'm Tom Ryan. I'm your host, my lovely wife and co-host, probably exhausted after cooking all day yesterday for a house full of people. But I hope everybody's having a great holiday weekend, resting up. This is what I usually consider to be the shadow show, the show where I feel as though I'm talking to nobody.
Show.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anybody out there who genuinely listens on a holiday Friday. Everybody's out shopping and doing whatnot, but maybe not. Maybe there's people who are tuning in. I hope so. We started something brand new last week. We started a series dedicated to Bing Crosby, as you had just heard mentioned. Thank you very much for the plug 2 minutes before we do it. But we opened our show last week with basically talking about Bing's early life. And this show actually picks up at the point in time where he basically starts his very first recordings. There's a lot of backstory. We did most of the backstory last week.
Thank goodness.
Right. We'll pick up with the rest of it right now. Most of this is coming from a really great book by Gary Giddens called Bing Crosby, A Pocketful of Dreams, The Early Years, 1903 to 1940.
He was a wild man.
Bing?
There's
a lot about him that people, you know, that our generation seems to have forgotten or overlooked or just decided to not acknowledge because our idea of what cool is changed. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that it left Bing feeling a bit alienated as well. I mean, you know, rock and roll was not going to do much for his career. That's for sure. But things were different back in the 20s. And that's where we're picking up our story right now as I read from this book. The day after they got the call. The call, by the way, is when they had heard that Paul Whiteman, who was the single most popular musician in the universe at that point in time, he was pretty much the king of American music. He ran the most popular big band in America.
The king of cool.
He was So they got a call saying that he was interested in meeting with them, and they kind of didn't even believe it. But
I could not believe their ears.
So Bing and Al walked backstage at the Million Dollar Theater, and they knocked on Whiteman's dressing room door. Bing remembered the huge Whiteman sitting on a bed looking like a giant Buddha, and he had a pound of caviar in his lap and a bottle of champagne on his breakfast table. The ultimate in attainment. Now, chances are that is Bing exaggerating the story. Almost no doubt that's Bing exaggerating the story. But it makes for a good tale. And it really is telling in terms of how much they thought of him.
It conjures an image.
Yes.
Sure.
And Whiteman was not a small man by any stretch of the imagination. And the fact that he was so incredibly, he was essentially was the king of the music industry at that point in time. So even if he was sitting there in his underwear and a beer, I think that Bing Crosby would have seen him as this Buddha-like figure with champagne and caviar. According to Bing's partner, Al, Whiteman made a point of saying that he had seen the act before making them an offer. "You guys are good," he told them. "How would you like to join my band?" He offered them a featured spot at $150 a week each.
"Yes, please."
"Well, how does that sound?" he asked. "Go ahead, boys. Talk it over." The two men exchanged grins. Bing spoke up. "Al and I don't have to talk it over, Mr. Whiteman," he said. "We accept your offer. How soon would you want us to start?" "As soon as possible," Whiteman told them, at which point Al said to Bing, "Say, what about our contract with Jack Partington?" Because they were signed to Partington through November. Whiteman thought for a moment and advised them to complete the contract and join the band for its 3-week stay in Chicago. "That will give you a couple of weeks to relax," he said. The next day, they returned to Whiteman's dressing room with Al's dad to sign the papers. Before taking off on his tour, Whiteman shook hands with them and said, "So long, I'll see you sprouts in Chicago." Al's sister, who was Mildred Bailey, we played a track by her last week to introduce her. Mildred was delighted, as was Partington, relieved perhaps that they intended to honor their contract. 11 months and 1 week before, Bing and Al had left Spokane in a tin Lizzie.
Unbelievable.
Just to see my sister, hoping we could get something going, Al marveled. Now they were about to work with their idol, scaling what Bing described as the Mount Everest of show business.
Crazy.
Al thought he was living a Horatio Alger fable. Bing credited luck. Yet, it would be a mistake to discount the appeal and originality of their act. Audiences loved them, and Whiteman wasn't risking much. He wanted something fresh and jazzy, something for younger people, and who better than these two clean-cut kids? He had no way of knowing that in signing them, he had just put into motion the career of the first in a long line of white musicians who popularized real black music. Jazz, not mammy singing. For a white public. This was 10 years before Benny Goodman launched the swing era, 30 years before Elvis Presley rocked.
Awesome.
Timing is everything. Monday morning, December 6, 1926. They packed blazers and got to the theater as the bandstand was set up. Whiteman arrived at noon, delighted to find them waiting. Well, I see you made it, and right on time. He introduced them to the musicians. They seemed very pleased to have us with them, Al recalled, but asked Bing and Al to sit out the two afternoon shows to get a feel for the production from backstage. The show dazzled them as much as it had in Los Angeles. By evening, they were nervous but raring to go. Whiteman gave them a pep talk and went to work. Al described their initiation. The first evening show was about to start, and we were all made up and ready. There was a full house out front. Whiteman told us that we would go on about the middle of the show and that he would introduce us as Crosby and Rinker, who were making their first appearance with his band. Well, our turn finally came, and Paul walked out and started our introduction. What he said was far different than what we had expected. He told the audience that he had heard two young boys singing in an ice cream parlor in a little town out west called Walla Walla. They sang some songs, and I wondered what they were doing in Walla Walla. These kids were good, too good for Walla Walla, so I asked them to join my band. This is their first appearance with the band, and here they are. I want you to meet Crosby and Rinker. Come on out, boys. The little piano was moved on stage, and Bing and I came out from the wings. All I know is that we got a big hand after our first song and even more applause on our second number. To top it all, we were called back for an encore. That was our first appearance on the big time. You can bet we were two happy guys. Whiteman came over to us after the show and said, "Well, how do you feel? I knew they'd like you. Welcome to the band." Bing's stay in Chicago was eventful for other reasons, too. After Whiteman completed his week at the Uptown Theater, he reserved the cavernous orchestra hall for 2 days of recording on December 21 and 22. The session that Bing had done with him, the only acceptable number that was pulled from that with Bing, was a rendition of Ruth Etting's Wistful in Blue, which, by the way, is how we ended our show last week with that exact recording, which was the very first time Bing opened his mouth on an actual recording.
Cool.
Coupled with an instrumental from the day before, it was the first of nearly 100 titles that Bing and Al recorded under Whiteman's aegis. Dated as it is today, their record debut was novel in 1926. So we heard that already. Moving on. The Paramount, a flagship of the Publix chain, was a jaw-droppingly opulent theater and the quintessence of big-time entertainment. Whiteman's musicians liked to pretend it was just another gig, even if it paid them $9,500 for the week.
Whoa.
Variety loved their show, complaining only that it was short. Toward the end of the set, Whiteman introduced his dynamic find from the coast. Variety was pleased. As they quote said, "Rinker and Crosby, a smart two-man piano act who sing ditties differently and are of the Van and Schenck class. After Whiteman gets through grooming the boys, there will be plenty in the money." The critic went on to note that they vocalized two numbers and accepted as many encores. No one else remembered it that way. Not only were there no encores, but the audience sat on its hands, quiet as a grave, a freeze frame.
Yikes.
For the next 2 days, Bing and Al repeated the act that had always wowed them in the Midwest, to more silence. The theater manager wanted them out, and Whiteman complied. They laid dinosaur eggs, he recalled.
No
one could explain it. So suddenly, now that they're back in the big city, they're not hitting it.
Weird.
The second-story block-long club that Whiteman opened on Broadway and 48th Street to a packed, star-studded, bring-your-own-hooch crowd in which Prohibition agents mingled with Governor Al Smith, Mayor Jimmy Walker, and two rival club owners, Jimmy Durante and Texas Gannon. Charlie Chaplin, Gene Angles, Gloria Swanson, and Harry Warren.
Wow.
Evangelist Amy Semple McPherson dropped by a few days later, bringing greetings from Whiteman's father, who was conducting her choir. Entered by a carpeted staircase, the ornate black and gold room could accommodate between 900 and 1,000 customers. As a result, what passed for a full house in other places, maybe 100 filled tables, was a disaster at Club Whiteman. In 3 months, Paul would unload his 50% interest and retract his name. Meanwhile, he used the club to give Bing and Al another shot at New York. But he scheduled them during intermission between the floor shows. They worked by the side of the stage under a spotlight. Al at a white piano adorned with Paul's caricature. Without microphones, they were unable to claim the attention of the audience. After two nights, the perplexed Whiteman dropped their act. He allowed them to earn their keep, however, opening and closing the bandstand curtains.
Oh, my.
Wow. A week after Club Whiteman opens its doors, Paul scheduled the band for a week of recording sessions at Victor's New York studio. Whiteman knew he had something special in Bing, and if New York put any doubts in his head, violist Matty Malnick was there to allay them. 3 days later, Whiteman recorded Matty's intricate arrangement of a wonderful recent song by Will Marion Cook and Donald Haywood, I'm Coming Virginia, with Bing taking his first solo and Al harmonizing only on the final scat chorus. Yet four tries failed to produce a satisfactory take, and they left the studio in a state of bitter frustration. 3 days after that, on March 7th, at New York's Liederkranz Hall, Whiteman's faith was rewarded as the band assigned another Malnick arrangement called Muddy Water. Muddy Water did not electrify the music world. It was no heebie-jeebies or Heartbreak Hotel, though sales were respectable. Yet, Crosby's first recorded chorus, 32 measures, was every bit as radical, nothing remotely like it had been heard before. The song, with its bucolic theme of an idyllic life down Dixie Way, was cannily appropriate for a Dixie-file like Bing. Yet, his delivery is never patronizing or sentimental. He bets everything on his rhythmic phrasing and gives each word its due. Let's hear that track now. Here's Bing Crosby with, of course, the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, Al Rinker on harmonies, singing Muddy Water.
Muddy there, but still it's my home. Got my toes turned Dixie way. Round that delta let me lay. My heart cries out for muddy water.
There it is. Now, it's hard to put all this in perspective, but hearing Bing sing there, compared to some of the stilted vocalists that were present.
A lot of people were much stiffer.
Much.
In their delivery.
Hearing him basically like rolling his way through the notes gave the song like almost an element of swing. And it sounded so casual, and it was an amazing thing to be able to sound casual. The other thing, of course, is the way the song itself is structured. You might think, where is the vocals? Is this, I thought you said Bing Crosby was going to sing on this. Well, back then, I mean, the orchestra was the featured attraction, so you would come in to sing, as you would hear there, for your section, but really it was the band that was the star.
Right.
So you did your bit, and then you stepped back again, and you deferred to the band. Of course, the structure of that started to change drastically as pop songs began to...
And microphones probably helped change that, too.
Well, exactly. This is exactly the things that we're going to be covering in this series as we move forward. But getting back to the book, then, to read what it has to say. No singer had ever come close to swinging on a Whiteman record or with any other white ballroom band. For that matter, in early 1927, hot vocals were practically unheard of on records by black orchestras.
Hmm.
Except for a single brief scat break by Louis Armstrong that he strongly disfavored, Fletcher Henderson confined vocals to Don Redman's Singspiel. The earthier territory bands of the Midwest tended to limit vocal choruses to novelties. Crosby's very presence was singular. He was the first ever full-time band singer, not an instrumentalist who doubled on vocals.
That's
another crazy thing.
That's
right.
That's a huge innovation.
I mean, of course, Louis Armstrong is turning the whole world on its head. But even him, not quite yet, not at this point in time. Because as we just heard right there, at this point in time, Louis Armstrong is not on his own. He's now working with Fletcher Henderson.
Right.
And he's not known in a universal way yet. Anyway, as frenetic as Bing was calm, new member Harry Barris, about to join the group, at 21, was the quintessence of jazz age show business, or at least he thought he was. He played piano, sang, joked, and wrote songs, though he had yet to sell any, and was brazen with confidence. One of the first people Barris looked up in New York was an old friend, Jimmy Cavanaugh, who toured in vaudeville performing original material, none of which caught on. After the two downed a few beers, Cavanaugh showed Harry a lyric he was working on and asked whether he could do anything with it. Harry walked to the piano and fashioned a melody. They called their song Mississippi Mud. Melnick, determined to help three fish out of water, told Harry about Bing and Al, suggesting that they might team up. Harry was initially skeptical. If one of them played piano, what would he do? But Matty arranged a meeting at which Harry banged out his new tune, and the rapport was instant. The next day, we went over to Barris's apartment, Al recalled, to work out a routine. We fooled around with some ideas, and we tried out some three-part harmony. We were all baritones, but I had the highest voice, so I sang the top part. Barris sang in the middle, while Bing sang the low part. One of Harry's tricks in his solo act was to slam the top of the piano for an effect and make the sound of a cymbal with his mouth. This sounded great, and all three of us were getting our kicks at the way we sounded. We all came up with ideas. Bing took most of the solo parts, and Barris and I would fill in with answers or a rhythmic scat background. Although we weren't conscious of it, we were creating an entirely new style of singing pop songs. We were far more jazz-oriented than any other singing group of that time. We were greatly influenced by the great jazz musicians we had heard and were working with. We were very free and uninhibited. Now, you got to hear this song. Keep in mind now, please, this is pre-1930, so the allusions to black culture on this song would be considered grossly inappropriate by today's standards. But 85 years ago, it was actually maybe even forward-thinking that you'd have white people singing about black culture in a positive manner at all. So I guess it all deserves to be at least put into perspective. As I said, the name of the song is Mississippi Mud.
What are you fellas moaning about?
That Mississippi mud. When the sun goes down, the tide goes out, the darkies gather round and they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Dud, it's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi mud. It's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi mud. Oh, what a dance do they do. Lordy, how I'm telling you. They don't need no band. Take your time by clapping their hands. Just as happy as a cow chewing on a cud when the darkies meet the feet on the Mississippi mud. Lordy, how they playing. Boy, they really swaying. Da 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 da. Say, that music thrills me. Boy, it nearly kills me. When the sun goes down, the tide goes out, the darkies gather round and they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Dud, it's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi mud. It's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi mud. Oh, what a dance do they do. Lordy, how I'm telling you. They don't need no band. Take your time by clapping their hands. Just as happy as a cow chewing on a cud when the darkies beat the feet on the Mississippi mud.
You say mud there, boy?
I said mud, son.
What are you getting at, lad?
I said really black mud.
Well, speaking of mud and rain always reminds me.
Reminds you of what?
That I left my sugar standing in the rain. And my sugar melted away.
His sugar melted away. I said his sugar melted away.
Sweeter than the sugar from the sugar cane. Why, I didn't mean to treat her that away.
He didn't mean to treat her that way. Why did you treat that girl that way?
Well, I don't know. I'll bet your sweetie thought that you were the lowest kind of a kind.
Maybe. You never realized she was so refined, now, did you?
Irregardless and respected,
I just left my sugar standing in the rain. And my sugar melted away. Da 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 da. Hey, hey, Uncle Duffy, butter. What a dance do they do. Lordy, how I'm telling you. They don't need no band. They take your time by clapping their hands. Just as happy as the cow chewing on a cud when the darkies beat the feet. Saying the darkies beat the feet. Saying the darkies beat the feet on the Mississippi mud. But I left my sugar.
Where'd you leave your sugar?
Standing in the mud.
In the mud? I'll bet she's plenty muddy now.
Wow, right? You got. I mean, it's really hard to convey. I'm doing my best, but to say that that song was something of a
time capsule.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shocker in 1925 as far as what it meant in terms of like giving songs a spirited sense, and especially with like, you know, up to this point, three-part harmony was barbershop.
Right.
You know, and this took it to a, now it's like that you can do jazz three-part, really? It was a brand new thing. It was cool. And irrespective of the fact that they do use the word quote-unquote darky, which is obviously horribly offensive right now, it's light years ahead of the blackface that was common at the time. And it really was their way, actually, of trying to show sensitivity toward black culture because they were so like inspired and infected by it. Being like us was totally enamored with the South. And to be say, if you say you're enamored with the South, that meant you were enamored with black culture because that was really the difference. All of the music that was coming out of the South for the
Absolutely.
Most part was coming from black culture. So anyway, they play this. And back to the book. Whiteman flipped. He installed them in his dying club the next Saturday night, bringing in a second white spinet to match the first. The house was nearly full. Paul introduced them as the pianos were wheeled out. Bing stood between them with his cymbal. According to Rinker, they slammed the piano lids and carried on. You can bet the audience at the Whiteman Club could hear us now. The crowd not only listened, but stopped dining, drinking, and talking, and applauded enthusiastically for both numbers. Barris had the least distinctive voice of the three, but his sizzle and high-strung energy inspired Bing and Al, whose curtain-pulling days were now over.
Good for them.
Back into the recording studio in April, Bing this time was more himself on Malnick's readaptation of I'm Coming Virginia, the song that he and Rinker had flubbed at a previous session. With Barris adding only a ha-cha-cha coda, here, Bing captures the originality of Muddy Water, combining his deft time with a full, relaxed articulation of the words. Contrary to Al's suggestion of a diligent jazz influence, two surviving takes show that their scat routines were worked out to the last detail. Yet, Bing's imperturbable vocal, Maddie's writing, Nichols' solo, and the band's skill combined to make I'm Coming Virginia the best and the most authentic jazz record that Whiteman had ever made. That's in his career. Let's hear that track right now.
I'm coming, Virginia, I'm coming to stay. Don't hold it again me or run away. I've tried to forget you, but I found I'm all wrong. Need your bright southern moon once more, I'll croon that dear old mammy tune. And if I can win ya, I'll never more roam. I'm coming, Virginia, my Dixieland home.
Ta-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
That's a fascinating recording by really just about any standard, I think. It goes through so many interesting changes, and it's historically very relevant. It marks the very first time that the Rhythm Boys are caught in front of a microphone, the Rhythm Boys being Harry, Al, and Bing together, the three of them as a trio. It's also has that great trumpet solo. That's Red Nichols. Red Nichols ran a unit, by the way, called the Five Pennies,
okay,
which was like really trying to be a regular jazz band. And it was through an association with Whiteman, was impressed with them to incorporate them into the band. So it's interesting that it introduces the Red Nichols for the first time, as it's also introducing the Rhythm Boys.
Huh.
Red Nichols didn't last long with Whiteman because he was unhappy playing what he called "quote unquote" compromised jazz, too much prearrangement. In his mind, as opposed, and not enough swing for him. So eventually they would part ways. So.
Fair enough.
Exactly. Now, with Whiteman, I mean, this is also part of his history. I want to make sure I'm not forgetting something here. Good. The next week's sessions represented a turning point, a crucial shift in the Whiteman band that led to the most durable music, including their recording of Rhapsody in Blue. The very first time that that song was debuted was through Paul Whiteman's orchestra of Paul's long career. Two selections recorded at the November 1927 dates, Changes and Mary, established Bing as the choice singer among Whiteman's musicians, some of whom would now regard him as one of the band's top soloists, period. Let's hear one of those two tracks. Let's hear Changes.
Listen, I forgot, since he was a top, he's been the talk of Dixieland.
Changes with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And indeed, Changes were afoot with another hot trumpeter player coming into the picture here. I'll read from the book. Walter Donaldson's Changes could not have been more aptly named. The song embodied the changes in the Whiteman band, the old guard giving way to the new, the old dance band aesthetic succumbing to the improvised vitality of jazz. Of course, the title also suggests the bullish transformations of a nervous pre-depression America that during the previous 6 months alone had witnessed Lindbergh's flight, Sacco and Vanzetti's execution, Babe Ruth's 60 home runs, and The Jazz Singer, the first full-length talking picture. A lot going on.
Yeah, big changes.
The Sweet Trio sings the first theme in strong mid-range unison. The Rhythm Boys follow with a high-voiced harmony singing four bars and scatting four more. The third theme is all Bing, followed instantly by a glorious cornet improvisation by none other than Bix Beiderbecke.
Awesome.
That's what we had heard there, which was causing problems in the Whiteman band because in comes this young upstart, Bix Beiderbecke, who is not taking care of himself
at all. He had a huge drinking problem.
Right, and Whiteman had another trumpeter named Henry Busey, who was under contract to be on every track ever recorded, but they let him sit that one out, and he was offended that basically Bix seemed to be suddenly taking over
in favor
a substantial role in Whiteman's orchestra because of the jazz genius that he was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 2 days after Changes, another tune defined the band's stylistic divisions. Mary entangles trumpeter Busey and Bix, much as Changes connected the Sweet and Hot Singers. After an ensemble introduction, Busey's muted trumpet states the theme in damp staccato over a starchy boom-cha-boom-cha rhythm. Then Bix takes over the brasses for a verse, delivering them and the entire ensemble into the sunshine of swing. Toward the end of the performance, Bix begins his flaming eight-bar improvisation with an impatient rip and, leading the brasses in contrapuntal fingers, all but drowns out Busey's reprisal of the theme. Yet, with all that, Bix isn't the key soloist. Bing is. Voice restored, he sings his chorus with exemplary finesse, articulating details at a cantering tempo and balancing rhythmic heat with vocal cool. He reshapes the melody, improving Donaldson's cadences, displaying a jazz license all his own. The kind of liberties he took, however subtle, were not often appreciated by songwriters and publishers who were known to threaten legal action over an altered note or word. Time was changing. Bing Crosby, right there at the heart of it. Here's that song. Listen to the difference in the trumpet styles and try to imagine, if you will, how Bing Crosby's vocals on this song is literally changing the face of music.
They're buzzing right in my ear, and they keep on asking, hey, what's the big idea? Think of the moon above, doesn't it speak of love, Mary? Why do you leave me on? Why do you be so contrary? You wouldn't let my castles come tumbling down. Think of the things in store, what are you waiting for, Mary?
Telling track there from a historical perspective. Yeah. Insiders Bing was now becoming something of a Bixian hero. Just as Bix proved that a white musician could be an expressively nonconformist jazz player, Bing showed that a white male vocalist did not have to sound like a Floridora girl. Bing felt like a musician. He had his own sound. He improvised. He had time, which is to say a sense of time. 2 days after Christmas, Showboat opened at the Ziegfeld, a turning point for the American musical theater, and as it happened, a milestone for Bing. Whiteman assigned arranger Bill Challis Old Man River from the magnificent score by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II. Challis went to work preparing the chart for Bing. That week, Whiteman debuted on NBC with his own show. Scheduled to sing, Bing alerted his family, but those in Spokane who huddled around their radios were disappointed when he sang and was not identified, an indication of how inside his reputation was. Old Man River would help to change that. Let's hear that track right now.
But he must know something, cause he just keeps rolling. He keeps rolling along, rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton. Them that plants them is soon forgotten. But Old Man River, he keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk and you land in jail. I gets weary, sick of trying, I'm tired of living, feared of dying, but Old Man River keeps rolling along. Thank you.
Wow, just so funny how to hear, even for me, this is like a bit of an eye-opening experience when you play this stuff chronologically from the 20s now, and we all know how many changes that song has gone through
right
in time. Well, that record was a sensation. Months later, Whiteman sought to extend its success by recording another version with Paul Robeson, for whom the song was originally conceived, and a choir. But Bing's triumph was singular. Coming on the heels of such sentimental Whiteman bestsellers as Together, with vocals by somebody named Jack Fulton, and Ramona, with Skin Young, now both forgotten, it created a stir among musicians and fans, expanding Whiteman's following among younger listeners.
Cool.
Cultural historian James T. Mayer, in high school at the time, believed Bing's version spoke specifically to his generation.
Awesome.
Johnny Mercer was transfixed by it. It seemed to me he employed a completely new and different style, which sounded more natural and effortless than any I'd ever heard. It was really, this is me ad-libbing down, that it was Bing's ability to sound as though he wasn't trying that made everybody fall in love with him so much. And it was what gave him such incredible appeal to youth. He was becoming, for lack of a better expression, the rock star of his time.
It just goes to show how much true love he must have had for the genre to feel that comfortable singing his words.
Yes, and it was also a matter of just his personality.
Right.
Bing was one that would basically just, you know, he was like that expression about like water off a duck's back. He didn't let things bother him enough, especially in terms of from any artful thing. He just made it all seem so incredibly easy.
He was nonplussed.
And that was what was so appealing to his audience. All right. Well, obviously, Bing developed a uniquely spirited sang-froid. No matter how jazzed up the setting, he negotiated the words, rhythm and melody with a polished timbre and flawless enunciation. Even on off days, Crosby's instrument radiated confidence. Most of his predecessors, who were not belters, belonged to the genteel school and sang with effete head tones. Bing conveyed a chest tone approach, making full use of his diaphragm. His vocal mask was complete and mature, but his most extraordinary gift was to communicate naturally. While other pop singers employed ponderous or flaccid tones, Bing sang the same way that he spoke. His style avoided the mannerisms of style. His art seemed artless, even effortless. One example is his stunning chorus on Groffé's breakneck version of Showboat's Make Believe, which I believe we'll get to next week. The instrumental chorus is ornate, but Bing's vocal, backed by Steve Brown's stomping bass, marries rhythmic panache to pitch-perfect articulation and underscores the lyric's meaning and charged tempo. Satterfield reflected Chalice's influence in his finest arrangement, a song called There Ain't No Sweet Man That's Worth the Salt of My Tears. A jazz classic with Bix driving the ensemble and Bing rattling his first word, a rhythmically italicized I'm, for a sensational entrance. The song's unchanged gender reflects the obstinacy of song publishers who would not allow singers to alter pronouns. Bing was not permitted to sing There Ain't No Sweet Gal. Since the great majority of songs were conceived as male entreaties to woman, the sanctity of pronouns discouraged the employment of female singers, a convention that Whiteman eventually breached when he hired Al's sister Mildred Bailey into his band.
Hmm.
But here is Bing singing that track, though, paying attention to what was then considered conventional at the time. Leave those pronouns alone.
Thank you. shaking like a leaf on a tree that's coming loose from the stem. Shaking like a leaf on a tree, because I'm coming loose, my man. I'm like a weeping willow, weeping on my pillow. For years and years, there ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of my
body.
Down and down he dragged me, like a fiend he nagged me. For years and years, there ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of my
body. Although I may be blue, still I'm through, I must tell him goodbye. Rather than have that man gonna lay me down and just die.
So, broken-hearted sisters, aggravated misters, lend me your ears, there ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of my
ba-da-da-da, wa-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da, wa-da.
Have it, of course, there ain't no sweet man worth the salt of my tears. It sounds so odd to hear a male chorus, you know, with the lead singing that now, but that was a sign of the times what had happened. Heidi, you brought up a point during that. I should at least mention this now. Of course, with our series, How Music Changed, which we've been doing on Fridays now for a good number of years, we have already done a series dedicated to Big Spiderback.
Right.
So if you're interested in hearing this tale told from a different perspective, for Heidi and I, this is really, we're actually sort of excited because we did the Big Spiderback story from Bix's perspective, from the history of that. And it was great to hear that history. And now we're reliving aspects of it now, but it's from Bing's perspective with Bix being in the band.
Right.
And it's kind of cool to see how they link together.
Yeah.
If I would say, if you had the time, if you wanted to basically check out some history, if you go onto our website, AmericanHitNetwork.com, and you search back, if you just search on How Music Changed on the Friday shows, you're just going to basically, if you dig back far enough, you're going to see the Bix Spiderbeck series. And I think you'd have a good time playing this. I'm not sure how many we did. It might have been four or five shows
something
dedicated
like
to Bix. Well, we've got time for one more here, so let's do the introduction and then we'll let you all be. Within weeks, Bing Crosby was also featured on Malnick's strongest arrangement since I'm Coming Virginia, perhaps his finest ever, the definitive version of From Monday On. For orchestra and all six singers. A Barris original with input from Bing on the lyric, the song was first recorded by the Rhythm Boys in January. That performance marked Bing's debut as a whistler and includes an awkward Al Rinker chorus that publicly revealed what everyone in Whiteman's fold knew. A huge musical gap existed between the former musical adherents. Bing was beginning to take off and leave his compatriots behind him, not deliberately, but just by virtue of the fact that he simply couldn't help himself. Here's that track from Monday On, and I hope you can join us next Friday as we pick up and move on with our history of Bing Crosby. Take care, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Every day was blue day. Still you love me true. Say all my tears have gone away. Thank you.
from Monday on, my cares are over. From Monday on, I'll be in clover. We picked on Monday because it's wash day, and we'll wash our blues away. From Monday on, the skies will look bright. Don't tell me different, I know I'm right. I'm gonna start shouting, hey, hey, when he says love, honor, and obey, 'cause I'll be happy from Monday on.